From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, boon or bust, a familiar story in West Texas, and right now it's a boon, but the people there are still busting to make ends meet. The drought is drying up the Texas plains, creeks, and towns, the story of Plainview and its drought-busted economy. Man's best friend is part of America's war machine, but researchers are finding that the dogs of war also suffer from PTSD. And how crazy does someone have to be not to be executed in Texas? The story of death row inmate Andre Thomas, who gouged out his own eyes. This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. The fortunes of the oil industry have always written the history of the Permian Basin, and today, nearly three decades after the last boom and bust cycle, Odessa, Midland, and the Permian Basin are definitely in an expansion mode. People are flocking to the area, drawn by rapidly increasing salaries, where a roughneck willing to work can make $100,000 a year. But there is another side to the story of rising oil revenue, and that's the rising cost of living that comes with it. West Texas Public Radio reporter Lauren Madelon reports from Odessa.
It seems the funeral for the Permian Basin oil industry was premature. New technology, namely fracking and horizontal drilling, allow extraction of once inaccessible oil at the right price. And the basin is jammed right now with workers from all over the world.
Everybody's here for the money.
The reason I came out here is for the money.
Make money, the boom. I mean, everybody is out here making money.
Numbers in this case are very telling. Odessa has issued 572 permits for new housing in the last year. Normally, that number's at 50. Third-rate, roadside motels cost $100 a night if you can find a vacancy. World-class musicians like violinist Itzhak Perlman, B.B. King, and the Oak Ridge Boys pack Midland's Wagner Noel Fine Arts Center.
We've got two oil field supply companies back in there.
Guy Andrews is the Economic Development Director at the Odessa Chamber of Commerce.
Union Pacific's about to put in a big rail yard out here on 200 and something acres.
He's driving by once vacant flatlands transformed into a nest of construction cranes.
This is gone crazy.
Back in his office, Andrews says the Permian Basin feels like a new frontier.
We've had normally a boom and a bust cycle, but this one's sustainable for a number of years. It's almost like we just discovered oil.
Oil rigs operating 24/7. They're the sound of money. And Andrews can say that the good times should last because the Permian Basin is at the center of a perfect storm. The oil play extends across hundreds of square miles of West Texas. The cost of extraction is falling, and operations will remain economically viable even if the cost of crude falls to $60 or $70 a barrel. Right now, it's around $96.
And it's also equity financed rather than debt. A lot of money's been on the sideline in our economy, and this is a place where people can make a return on their investment, so we're seeing all of the big capital investors coming in here.
Equity versus debt means companies are financed by investors directly rather than having to sell corporate debt like bonds to finance their operations. The lure of the Permian Basin extends worldwide. Akinrin Made is a petroleum engineer from Nigeria.
I've been in Odessa almost a year now.
The Niger Delta of Nigeria is a crucible of oil exploration and extraction, with plenty of work to go around. But Made chose to come to West Texas, where he tells a familiar story.
A lot of people have been relocating over here now because of the job. But the other thing that is really, really tough is housing. You find it difficult to get a living area. And if you can get one, it's very expensive.
Right now, I am passing a sign which reads Odessa City Limits. Of course, it has a population count on it. But economists say that trying to come up with exact population figures in the Permian Basin right now is a little bit like drinking water from a fire hose. It just can't be done. The influx is that strong. Of course, for people who live and work here, that influx represents a double-edged sword. Their salaries are rising rapidly, but so too is the cost of living.
We have a travel trailer. It burned down on the 1st of January. We haven't been able to find another place.
Now, Betsy Donaldson sleeps on the floor of her boyfriend's parents' house. She lived in Fort Worth for 11 years before moving to Odessa to work in the restaurant business.
You know, it's nice having a lot of people around. It's nice having new businesses and things. But it's tough because I know it's not forever. You know, it will go away. Everybody's house values will drop, and they'll still be paying mortgages that are really, really high for houses they can't sell. And so this is what's going to happen. You know, it's just a matter of time.
That said, the list of multinational energy companies and the companies that service them in Midland and Odessa is impressive, and they're positioned for the long haul. Ed Parker is an executive with Goliath Industries, a leading services company. Goliath is paid by oil companies to provide housing, meals, and related services to workers.
It's a tough thing to do, be away from your family that much, but we've got service people that go overseas, military people for a year or 2 years at a time. So a few weeks seems like a small sacrifice, but it's something that you have to get accustomed to.
Living at the Goliath installation in Odessa is Charles Moody. He's worked in North Dakota, Louisiana, and East Texas before getting in on the two sides of the Permian Basin expansion.
I moved from a $3,000 a month condo in North Dakota to an $800 a month two-story, five-bedroom, three-bath house in East Texas. They're wanting me to move here, and just looking here, you know, there's one-bedroom, one-bath homes for $1,800 a month already.
You're not there for Father's Day. You're not there for Christmas sometimes, you know, and for the delivery of my kids, you know, sometimes you got to miss it, and that's all part of the work.
That's Cesar Favela. He drives trucks to and from the oil fields. He came here from El Paso.
I do hate being away from my family, but it's good money. You know, I got a nice house for them. They dress nice, and, you know, the whole thing. You
know. That's a radio ad telling injured oil workers that a lawyer will visit them at home or in the hospital, another sign of ramped-up activity. So are salaries. $80,000 to $100,000 a year is not the exception. Catastrophic busts have often followed booms like this one, but many companies are betting that this one's different. Royal Dutch Shell is contemplating a move here, while Halliburton, Apache, and Flint Hills Resources, owned by Charles and David Koch, are just three of the major corporations already here. Flint Hills alone is spending $60 million just to move product pulled up here to its refineries elsewhere. In Odessa, I'm Lorne Matalon for West Texas Public Radio.
We want to take you on a trip now to Plainview, just south of the Texas Panhandle. The city has been at the center of the cattle industry for decades, but earlier this month, after more than 40 years in operation, the beef processing plant there shut its doors. Plant owners blame years of drought and the state's dwindling cattle supply. As KUT's Mose Bouchel reports for State Impact Texas, the closure could be a window into things to come for the Texas Plains.
Close that door, baby.
I got yours.
Just go.
Criselda Avila is 27 years old. She's a single mother of three, and until recently, she worked supporting her family at the Cargill XL beef processing plant at the skirt steak table. By the time the cows got to her work area, they'd been slaughtered and prepared for butchering. The carcasses came in hanging from a long chain that ran over the plant floor.
Peeling and trimming and just trimming the fat off is what it was. It's fajitas is what it is.
It was grindingly repetitive work. More than 4,500 cows went through the plant daily. When Avila was done with one, there was always another behind it. But just a few weeks ago, she saw something she never expected.
The last cow was coming down the chain and, well, you know, our people there were just banging, like, our hooks on the stuff and yelling, like, people started crying and like, oh my God, this is the end of it.
Avila never graduated from high school. And like many of the more than 2,000 workers who are laid off, she's not sure how she'll find another job that pays as well. She laughs and tells me she wishes she could win the lottery. She'd buy the plant and reopen it herself. Years of drought have left the Texas cattle herd at its lowest level since the 1950s. The Cargill company says there are simply not enough cows left to keep the plant running. In downtown Plainview, just a few blocks from Avila's house, the streets tell the story of just how central the cattle industry is to this town. Images of cows and cowboys are on every street sign. Statues of cows are everywhere, carved in wood, cast in metal, but mostly pressed in fiberglass as part of a decade-old project to promote tourism. The plant was part of what gave Plainview its identity. Now, in the domino logic of factory closures, no work at the plant means less business everywhere else. Tucked behind a grain elevator south of the Cargill plant, the Frisco Bakery has served up pastries and steaming plates of Mexican food for over 50 years. The Hispanic population the restaurant caters to is the largest single demographic in town. But on a recent Thursday evening, proprietors Irene and Ruben Olivas were closing up for the night and wondering how much longer their business will last.
Customers are leaving already, and we're very slow. We see the sales, and as far as cutting the meat that we need for the week at regular time, it's been going down.
Another business, a cleaning company with contracts at the Cargill plant, has already laid off its entire workforce of 125 people. Ruben Olivas immigrated to Plainview from Mexico years ago. Now he thinks a lot of people will be moving on. Now that people are leaving here, he says, you're going to see a lot of houses for rent. Instead of a growing Plainview, it's going to be a ghost Plainview. The term ghost town was used a lot while I was in Plainview. Plant worker Griselda Avila had said much the same thing. And over breakfast at the Frisco, Jose Ricardo Amaya said a lot of his relatives were already planning to leave.
Hopefully it doesn't go to a ghost town.
He said ghost town was more than just a figure of speech.
Yeah, a lot of the people. Yeah, it's going to hurt them. To relocate somewhere else where they can find a life again, they have to sell what they have.
That's, unfortunately, a not uncommon experience for the Great Plains of the United States.
Steve Murdoch used to be the state's demographer. He now runs the Hobby Center for the Study of Texas at Rice University. A lot has been made of Texas' population boom in recent years. But Murdoch says many counties in the Plains regions have consistently lost people. It's a trend that started years ago, as fewer and fewer people were needed for farming. Now the drought could be speeding up the process.
Substantial population loss can, in fact, occur and does occur.
At his City Hall office, Plainview Mayor Wendell Dunlap works to buck that trend.
Nobody is willing to let this community die because of this setback.
He said the key is to expand the city's business base, so another closure like this won't hit so hard. That could mean opening a technology training center at a local junior college or attracting new companies. There's even the off chance the processing plant could reopen someday. That's if the drought ends and cattle numbers rebound. But Dunlap says that would be years from now, and anyway, no one's counting on it.
We're pretty much operating as if the plant will not reopen.
And across the railroad tracks north of town where the Cargill plant used to operate, planning for the future seems like an abstraction. The people here are still grieving for what they've lost. The day before I left town, I walked by the plant. Birds were picking at bags of fast food that littered the parking lot. A few empty beer cans marked the spot of what might have been a farewell toast. And leaving the building after his last shift, I met Johnny Ray Muniz. He was carrying a certificate in a manila envelope.
It's a Value Cargill Employee Award. And it's... Oops. Oh, no!
A wind gust caught the certificate and blew it a few yards down the road before he retrieved it and read it to me.
I got it! Here we go. Let's try this way. It's a certificate of recognition. It's hereby awarded to Johnny Ray Muniz as a Value Cargill Employee for 6 years. Everyone matters. That's one good, positive thing, you know.
The envelope had the number 479. The everyone matters was all in caps. Ray Muniz said he'd like to stay in town if he can, but he isn't exactly sure what he'll do. Every time I make plans, he said, they never turn out the way I want them to. For State Impact Texas, I'm Mose Bouchel.
How crazy do you have to be not to be executed in Texas? There's little doubt that Andre Thomas, a convicted triple killer, is not sane. After the murders, he turned himself into police and has since gouged out his own eyes. He's on death row waiting for an execution date, but his lead attorney, Mari Levin, who also teaches at the UT Law School, says Thomas is insane and should not be executed.
Convicted and sentenced to death in Sherman, Texas, a week after he was arrested. He was sitting in jail in Grayson County, and citing the dictates of the Bible, he gouged out his right eye, and he was then declared incompetent to stand trial and sent off to a state hospital. And 47 days later, he was returned, and no one challenged his competency at that point, and he was convicted and sentenced to death. And a couple of years later, well, he was on Texas's death row, and after noticeably deteriorating and refusing to take his medication, he gouged out his one remaining eye and consumed it, And since that time, for the past 4 years, he has been housed at the Jester 4 facility, which is a unit of the Texas Department of Criminal Justice for the seriously mentally ill.
So when you say that he murdered his wife and his two children, that doesn't really tell the story of the horrific nature of the crime. Can you?
No, it doesn't. Andre is somebody who was exhibiting signs of mental illness as early as age 9 when he started hearing voices, and he continued to be psychotic and get worse as he grew older. He married Laura Boren on the day he turned 18, and they had a son, Andre Jr. And as Andre continued to get more and more mentally ill, as he descended into really extreme psychosis, when his son was 4 years old, Andre went to, he was not living with his wife or his son at the time, but he went to their home early in the morning, and he brought with him 3 separate knives, so he did not cross-contaminate, and he stabbed his wife and their son and her daughter, and then he cut out the hearts of the 2 children, and he was aiming for the heart of his wife, but instead cut out a piece of her lung. He then stabbed himself multiple times and laid down to die. And when he did not, he got up and he stuffed the organs in his pocket and he walked home and he turned himself into the police. After he got home, he picked up the phone and tried to call Laura and called her parents, saying that he kept on living the same day over and over again and he needed help. And then he turned himself into the police. And he had to go for open-heart surgery, without which he would have died because of the stab wounds he'd inflicted on himself. And then a week later, he took out his right eye while sitting in the jail.
This is not faking it. I mean, this is all terrible things that have happened as a result of his mental illness.
They are, yes.
He's not trying to use mental illness to cover something else that he did.
You would have to believe, you know, the longstanding history of his mental illness before the crime would seem to undermine any accusations that he was malingering or faking his mental illness if the fact that he took out his eyes didn't do it for you in the first place.
Obviously, he's insane, and we don't execute the insane. Why don't we execute the insane?
Well, I mean, the prohibition against executing the insane goes back many, many years, and it's not, you know, it's considered cruel and unusual punishment to execute those who are insane. And there's, you know, been a progressing body of jurisprudence out of the Supreme Court that attempts to define what that means and how you evaluate whether somebody is insane at the time of their execution. But Andre's case, I think, really presents a different set of problems and questions, because I think it forces us to ask why we would prosecute somebody capitally who was so clearly severely mentally ill.
What would happen to him if they decided that he wasn't sane enough to be executed? What would happen to him?
Andre Thomas would not be released, and nor should he, but nor should he be sitting on death row. Nor should he have ever been sent to death row.
Is Andre a unique case?
Absolutely. He's unique in the severity and florid nature of his mental illness. There are many people who are seriously mentally ill on death row.
But people can't make the floodgates argument, well, we do it for Andre, and then they have to do it for all the inmates who are on death row.
No. There is a threshold showing,
Like soon all the
Andre
inmates.
Andre is the only one on death row who has taken his eyes out.
Well, soon they'll all be plucking their eyes out just to get out of being executed. Someone could argue.
I mean, there are people who say that about Andre. It is not something, an argument that I can even take seriously. when you contemplate for a minute what it takes to gouge your own eye out. So, you know, no. Will it empty the row? No. Would a ruling in Andre's case mean that everybody's going to start faking their own mental illness? Well, I mean, they can try, but there are, you know, systems in place to prevent that from any such efforts from succeeding.
Mari Levin teaches at the UT Law School, and she's the lead attorney for Andre Thomas, a death row inmate that many say is insane and should not be executed. Thomas's case is profiled in Texas Monthly and on TexasTribune.org by Brandy Grissom. When America goes to war, American dogs are also sent into the combat zone alongside their human handlers. And researchers are finding out that, like some human warriors, these canines are returning home with symptoms of something like post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD. Texas Public Radio's Ryan Lloyd reports there's evidence that man's best friend needs some extra TLC after their tour of duty.
How's he been?
He's great.
Any issues?
None at all.
How's his crate training going?
Every morning, vet techs check over these playful and intelligent Belgian Malinois pups. Many of them likely eventually become four-legged warriors. They could end up in Afghanistan with their human counterparts looking for improvised explosive devices, IEDs, and fighting the Taliban.
Ultimately, we want these dogs to become military working dogs and go downrange and save lives.
Tech Sergeant Joe Knoll is a dog foster. His job is to socialize the dogs before they become canine soldiers. They are pampered and spend months playing, getting housebroken, and becoming accustomed to working with people.
Oh, you like that, Bonesy?
The Department of Defense's dog breeding program supervisor is Bernie Green.
It's people's way of giving back by adopting one of these dogs and fostering it for that period of time.
I'm just checking his ears.
When they are ready, the most energetic and playful dogs will be drafted and trained for combat. Once on the job, the stresses and rigors of war may take their toll on the dogs like they do with people. And sometimes the dogs would show signs that they were suffering from nervous exhaustion. Handlers saw their dogs appearing distressed and confused, forgetting routine commands. Doctors began wondering, could it be that canines experience post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD, like people? Walter Burkhardt is the chief of behavioral medicine and military working dog studies at Joint Base San Antonio Lackland.
It's not as if we're trying to call canine PTSD the same as human PTSD, although a number of the signs, the things that we see in the behaviors, are very similar.
That's why human psychiatrists, statisticians, and veterinary behaviorists gathered at Lackland to hash out what more people were noticing, that some dogs from war zones could be affected like people.
And it compromises the ability of the team to do its job.
Burkhardt says there was a case here, a case there, but then...
We started amassing more and more anecdotal cases and saying, gee, this looks like it's something for real. It looks like it's something that's consistently happening at a fairly low level, but it's something that's happening.
So far, half of the dogs identified with PTSD are able to go back into service. The others are retired and adopted out, or they are assigned other areas of service. Burkhardt says treating the dogs includes medicine or counterconditioning to untrain a PTSD behavior. Burkhardt says one problem is that each dog's health and deployment history isn't tracked the way a human warrior is. He wants that to change.
So we can actually capture the data and look at the dog and say, same or different from time to time. I think that's going to be a real benefit both on the medical side for the dogs, but also on the behavior side for problem behaviors, as well as for problems with performance.
30 to 50 military working dogs are being identified with symptoms of PTSD, and Burkhardt says the number is growing. That could be because more vets now know about it. Still, others aren't convinced canine PTSD is real.
You don't have to believe in this. You don't have to believe in bullets for them to kill you, you know? And you kind of present it in that fashion. It's like, oh yeah, I could see where that would be happening in a dog from time to time, and we need to start looking for it.
But he says the effects of PTSD in dogs and also in people could last long after the last U.S. troops leave Afghanistan. Ryan Lloyd, Texas Public Radio News.
A pair of TCU piano students are playing for a chance of a lifetime. Both hope they get picked for this spring's Clyburn International Piano Competition in Fort Worth. It's held once every 4 years. KERA's Bill Zeeble reports the two are among 20 auditioning this week in Fort Worth.
Mikhail Beresnev knows the odds are against him. By the time this last round of live auditions is over Friday night, The Clyburn screening judges will have heard 132 pianists in Milan, Hong Kong, and other cities. They'll only pick 30. But Russian-born Beresnev is confident. He came to TCU on a piano scholarship, and here's part of his screening performance.
Yeah, I felt very well. I felt very good. And I enjoyed to play here in Edlanders, and I love this hall. I think it's one of the best halls, actually. So I felt very well. Even I performed first, but it didn't disturb me a lot.
At age 24, Beresnev is young but experienced. He's finished at or near the top at competitions in Russia, Barcelona, and Australia. But getting a medal in the Clyburn can launch a career. Beresnev's TCU teacher, highly regarded Tamás Angár, says both of his students here did well, despite pressure that goes with this big competition.
They always get nervous. They always feel they have to give 110%, whether in the class or whether they do it in front of audience. So my feeling was that today specifically, they gave more because of the nerves. It's a creative nerve. It's not a nerve that sort of pushes you down.
Angár says Beresnev and his other Russian-born student, Anna Bolkina, who's 25, managed to dig deep, bringing out the music behind the written notes. Bolkina and her fellow TCU pianist Beresnev back each other. They hugged in the hallway after competing. Like Beresnev, Bolkina has done well in U.S. and overseas competitions. She also liked her audition here.
I think I did my best. I feel piano very well, and I feel very comfortable with the piano. Nothing like that disturbed me or something.
All the hopefuls here are trying to get into the Clyburn competition because it's considered the world's most prestigious. Players vie for $175,000 in prizes, recording deals, and most important, 3 years of U.S. and international concerts managed professionally. Clyburn judge Blanca Uribe of Colombia knows the benefits. She competed in this hall in 1966 and won bronze. 47 years ago, she says, there were no live auditions. And today, the world can watch the Clyburn competition on its live webcast.
The consciousness, especially, for instance, coming from South America, we were so separate from everything. And it took one a trip to the U.S. or to Europe to really realize, my goodness, what's happening. Now everyone is aware and everybody has to prepare accordingly.
And Uribe says her job may be a lot tougher these days. Pianists everywhere now know top competition standards and they're meeting them. Her job is to help pick the best for this competition that begins in May. Those 30 will be named March 5th. In Dallas, I'm Bill Zeeble.
That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. Thanks to contributing stations KUT Austin, West Texas Public Radio, and KERA Dallas. And we'd like to hear from you. Send your comments to texasmatters@tpr.org. You can also comment about the show on our website, tpr.org, which is where we have past Texas Matters programs that you can listen to. We're also on iTunes. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.